When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 170. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am tremendously excited to be heading down to North Herefordshire to talk to organic farmer and owner of the most iconic moustache since Tom Selleck, Ben Andrews. Ben, how are you?
Good, thanks. Good to be here, and yeah.
Is it raining down there, Ben, like it is here?
It's still coming down pretty hard. It's as you know, we all wanted it, didn't we? Let's not pretend it wasn't due, but like I said, could do a warming up a bit. That's about all I'm going to say on the weather. I get told off moaning about it too much anyway.
We've all been in the UK because we've had like 3 or 4 weeks of dry weather, and we call it a drought, don't we? And I always think farmers in Australia must just get really...
Although there's a little corner of Kent that I don't think it's had any.
No, yet.
And so there's a few down there that are tearing their hair out a bit.
Okay. So I'm going to read a new advert out now, a new sponsor for the podcast. Very exciting. From an up and coming company. So let's all give them our support. They're called Lima Grain, or LG for short. And I think we can expect great things from these plucky underdogs in the coming years. It says here that from Lima Grain's UK's market leading oilseed rape breeding program, Aurelia is the UK's number one hybrid variety, offering growers proven performance across all regions. It has exceptional autumn and spring vigor and outstanding disease resistance. Aurelia is a fully loaded hybrid combining turnip yellows virus, pod shatter, and RLM7 foamer resistance. It's like the Batman of OSR varieties. And you can learn more by visiting lgseeds.co.uk. Ben, you are very fortunate in Herefordshire, obviously, because it's so close to Wales. But perhaps you could tell us a bit more about the area.
Yeah, so Herefordshire is not Hertfordshire, which is the main plus point of it. I get it so much. It's like, oh, Hertfordshire. No, Herefordshire is different. Where's that then? Oh, it's near Wales. Oh, okay. We're bang on the border. Shropshire up above us, Gloucestershire that below us. Worcestershire over the one side, Wales over the other side. And it's been my home pretty much all my life, and pretty much my whole family's existence for at least the last 400 years. And so we don't get out much. And I think the furthest afield we've managed to come is sort of like a few of us have crawled over the border from Montgomeryshire and Radnorshire, but that's about it.
It's similar farming heritage to mine, and we haven't gone very far either, but have you traced back 400 years then? That's really...
I went on ancestry.com and just kept going back through them, I think well over 300 years, and we're in Vow Church, which is about 15-20 miles down the road from here. So that's the Andrews. That's the Andrews lineage. Wouldn't make the most exciting episode of Who Do You Think You Are, would it?
Tell us what you've got going on the farm there.
So we're mixed farm. We've always been a mixed farm. A little bit of arable. Grow all our own feed for the cattle that we finish, buy in stores, finished beef cattle, and also do some veg. So been doing that for just over between 15 and 20 years now. Okay. Doing lettuce, brassicas, kale, cabbage, cauliflower, kohlrabi, doing a few spring onions this year. We kind of know what works and what doesn't. Does pretty well, and it all ties in together. This mixed farming thing, growing your own feed for the cattle, all 100% our own feed, all organic, and then muck from the cattle. Veg loves that on the brassicas. It's all seems to work quite nicely together. And then also we've got the mid-tier stewardship scheme.
Okay.
We've been in, we were in the high level stewardship scheme for 10 years and then just started a new mid-tier scheme, the countryside stewardship. And that's all good fun. I love doing that. I mean, that's I get quite excited looking at birds and things.
Do you? Is that something you're interested in?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think it's, the bird thing is, I think it all happened. So over the last lockdown, you weren't able to go far. So you spend all your walking, on a light walking, and you get out around the farm, and we've got our wild bird seed mix, and I'd be out there, and you constantly see these birds around, it's a sparrow, it's a blackbird, it's a pigeon. And that's about the extent of my bird knowledge. Yeah. And I was like, so we've got some binoculars out. I was like, I wonder what that one is. So do that and Google.
Yeah.
You don't have to flick through the book anymore, do you? Type in little brown bird and it just comes up with a list of them. And you go, oh, it's that one. And linnets. Oh, apparently they're quite rare. There's loads of them. You get really excited by that. And then you just start to see these birds and sort of tell the difference. And then I think that sort of makes you realize that, that there is a natural world outside of our farming borders. And on top of the stewardship scheme, because we seem to grow sunflowers so bloody well in the wild bird mix, thought I'd have a crack at growing them for cut flowers this year.
Wow.
So it'll probably go horribly wrong. Matt Naylor, who we both know, does a really good job of growing them over in Lincolnshire. So I thought, how hard can it be? going in small, so like just with a little push along planter thing. Planter, but we'll see how they grow. But yeah,
that's exciting. It's interesting what you say about the birds, because it's something I've been. Very similar, really, for a long time, didn't sort of pay much attention. And then recent years, I've found myself very often on the RSPB bird identifier website. And recently I saw a bird and I wasn't quite sure what it was. And I had a look and I went down that and the thing told me it was a corn bunting. I got very excited and I thought, I'd taken quite a nice little picture of it. And I thought, I'll put it on Twitter and I'll say, what if it isn't? Everyone will... laugh at me or call me an idiot for a change. And of course I put it on there and said, this is a corn bunting, and some about 10 people messaged me and said, it's not a corn bunting, it's a song thrush. But at least I know what it is now anyway.
If you want to do anything and get told you're wrong, put it on Twitter.
Exactly.
I'm still after the elusive corn bunting, but we would just get the linnets. We've got field fares, red wings, song thrushes, get reed buntings, and missile thrushes. It's great seeing the missile thrushes because there's all these things that you've got thrushes, they love slugs and things.
Yeah.
When we're out planting, we'll see there's this big old missile thrush that bobs around and just jumps in front of the tractor. And then you get these pied wagtails coming in and the missile thrush is like, back off, man. this is my patch. And then the pied wagtail will get a couple of his mates in and they're like, no, come on. Yeah.
Gang of Newcastle supporters.
Let's have it then. Yeah. and then we all, so after some, t- in the past, I've had to stop the tractor and wait for this to like all unfold in front of the tractor. So get out of their systems, bugger off, so I can carry on, so I can carry on planting.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, there's a lot to ask you about there, but mixed farming. It's nice to be back in fashion, isn't it? I feel like we've been out of fashion as mixed farmers for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's odd because I think for such a long time, like I thought, well, everyone does a bit of everything, don't they?
Mm.
Oh, like, it just seems to make sense. I mean, you like spread your risk, don't put all your eggs in one basket. You have all this, like, you know, decent crop rotation gives you and a nice clover lay to have a bit of a break. Yeah, it helps manage with loads of like weeds and, mm-hmm. and pests and everything, and just seem to kind of make sense. And then you realize that some people just grow all of one thing. And
I'm
like, blimey, that seems a bit serious. but yeah, I'm like I said, it's something that I thought was the norm, and I guess it was the norm. And it was the norm for tens of thousands of years, or however long we've, you know, humans have been farming as a species.
Mm-hmm.
And we managed to do it for, you know, and I know we've, in the UK we deforested fairly early on, and it would be nice if we could take some of that back.
Yeah.
But you know, on a lot of land, like, you know, the land where we farm, we've not really been, you know, I know we've been organic for 20 years now, but it's never been particularly intensive.
Yeah.
We have used some chemicals in the past, but it's never been particularly intensive. And we managed to maintain high yields, and we managed to fatten cattle efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
From no synthetic inputs, no chemicals or fertilizers for the last 20 years, and our organic matter is fairly stable. Could always be better. Always keen to put a bit more in there, but
mm-hmm.
You know, that I think that FYM is it's pretty valuable stuff, isn't it?
Mm, definitely.
Yeah.
So why did you decide to go organic or I guess 20 years ago it was
dad's, yeah, your dad's decision. Money. The real answer was money, because at the time it was, yeah, there were a lot of financial incentives for going organic. It was being hailed as the next, you know, well, it was the next big thing.
Mm.
And I don't think that there was really any particular sort of environmental drive from a dad to go organic at the time, and mm-hmm. I think for a while you just assume that organic is just normal farming, but you can't use chemicals. And I think if you to reduce it to that, it can go horribly wrong, and you can mess a lot of things up, and you get, you know, we do suffer with weeds and stuff, but when you look at it from an IPM sort of point of view, and you start thinking about companion cropping and things like that, that's when you can really start to see the benefits of it. And I know there are some conventional farmers who are really doing some great things with companion cropping to make themselves, you know, look at the more environmental aspect of things. But it's, I think dad and I both now, you know, are more converted to the environmental side of things, and our farm does lend itself very well to being organic because it is mixed. And I think, you know, I'm sure there are people who are doing it, but I'm sure you struggle without some element, you know, even if it's not a mixed farm, without some sort of like muck for straw agreement with someone. But it's, yeah, like I said, 20 years and it's still going, and not really, you know, the soil is still doing its thing. We haven't run it into the ground yet, so gotta be doing something right. Yeah.
So tell us about the veg then. When did you start growing veg?
That was about wasn't straight after we converted to organic, but not long after, I remember dad sort of looking for something to, and I don't even remember, because yeah, my dad's not a big talker, so there was never really any sort of discussion about it. It's just like one day it's like a load of broccoli plants arrive on the yard.
Farming dads not being communicative. I don't know what... Yeah, I've got one of those as well.
But it was, yeah, like I was off at uni trying to learn how to be a farmer, and yeah, just he cracked on with it, and yeah, did well and went through a few different like markets to start with, and then sort of ended up settling fairly early on with Able and Cole, who are the most incredible company to grow for, and they are super fair with the price, and it's always a discussion, and they never tell you what they're going to pay you. They're like, so, you know, so what can you grow this for? And they're just really friendly, and if you don't have enough, they don't, you know, they won't penalize you for it, and if you've got too much, then they'll try and rejiggle things to take a bit more of it. And it's just a really, like, I couldn't deal with supermarkets.
That's how it should be, though, isn't it? That, yeah, you know, that's how it's supposed to work, isn't it?
Really? And I think that is what puts a lot of people off, and puts a lot of people off going down sort of a more mixed approach, and yeah, there's all, you know, the talk about agroforestry and putting, you know, fruit trees in and things. Like, the scariest thing is, what is your route to market?
Yeah,
like, supply chains are so limited that it's, you know, unless you're doing something really niche and doing a direct to consumer thing, it's like there are a couple of people like Able and Cole, these box schemes in the middle. And then it's supermarkets who just got the majority of everything tied up. So, you know, unless you're doing something on the sort of scale that you can supply supermarkets, you know, it's almost at like, I'm a bit scared to try it out, really. But I'd love a massive shake up of supply chains, but that's, I could spend an hour talking about that.
You mentioned some of the different veg that you're growing there, but how does the system work in practice? How are you sowing them? How does it look in the field?
We buy the plants ready germinated in, they come in these trays, 150 plants in a tray, and it's like a big compost slab that looks like a big slab of brownies. Everyone seems to say. It's got these plants in it, and it's they're all done for us over at Delftland Organics, Cambridgeshire direction. And we've had various planters in the past, various levels of human interaction with them, and like, my back is like just absolutely screwed. It's still, like, it's been some really torture machines of just, you know, like, sort of having to sit and just bend over to, like, physically forcing them into the ground and cutting them over by hand. And we've just moved up and swapped them in. And then last year, towards the end of last year, we bought this all singing, all dancing, sort of semi-automatic one where you just like feed the blocks in strips down this conveyor belt, and it's got this little robotic finger that like pulls them off and puts them into the ground for you. And you can do like, what are we doing? I mean, it's like something like 30,000 plants an hour.
Wow.
It's incredible. And you just, actually there's not 30,000 plants an hour. That's a complete over-exaggeration, but we can do about 50,000 in 4 or 5 hours. But, it's fantastic. Yeah. And like, I'm just, cause you know, when the weather's like this, we did a load yesterday, and you know, a few people on Instagram have said to me, it's like, oh, but I thought, you know, you'd be against all this mechanization. You'd be more for like employing people to come and put them in. It's like, well, like, if you're up against weather and you've got to get it in the ground, you like, you don't want to be mucking around, like putting these things up by hand. And I can guarantee you, not one person in the world wants to be planting these by hand. Cause it is, yeah. Cause I've done, I'd like to do, you know, all those hideous jobs. Like, I've done them all on the farm, and I can tell you for free that, like, I've had people, and we used to be like popping ibuprofen constantly throughout the day, just because you're like, your back is completely screwed. So I think it's, you know, if yeah, the industrial revolution happened for a reason, and I think there are a lot of things that people, you know, people wouldn't, you know, aren't out in a field with a scythe and a threshing machine, like,
no, yeah,
are they? So
no,
what extended specs
is, I mean, on that then, it is finding staff, and it's obviously quite labor intensive even now still with the new drill, but, you know, is finding staff a challenge?
It's not too, this year is going to be quite interesting because, of course, it's first year sort of post-Brexit, and we were lucky enough that, like, our main guy, we have one guy comes over from the Czech Republic every year, and he's been coming over for over 10 years now.
Okay.
And he's just someone that knows the job, and I can sort of leave him to do something while I go off and do something else. And a lot of the time that, you know, you can get people in seasonal labor every year, but, you know, by the time you've trained someone up to do it, you might as well have just done it yourself. Which is what happens a lot of the time. But it's, last year we had, I think it was probably closer to a 75% to 25% mix of local to Eastern European. So the majority were local people. And when I say, you know, I'm not talking anywhere near the sort of scale that a lot of these fruit and veg farms work at. You know, we're maximum, we'll have working out in the fields 10 people.
Okay.
And, you know, on a good day, like, I can be picking like 250, 300 lettuce in an hour sort of thing. So it's, we try and just make do on fairly small numbers. I don't like, you know, as long as people are working, not hanging around, just like standing, chatting, I'm not too bothered at the speed they work. I'm not like out there with a whip.
Cracking a bull whip.
Because I know, you know, you've got to sustain this for like 8 hours. So there's no point thrashing people. But yeah, it can be quite good fun when the weather's nice and you've got a bunch of people, and you can have a bit of a chat and you've got the radio going. There are worse places to be.
Definitely. So what are the biggest challenges to growing vegetables, especially being organic?
Pigeons right now,
I reckon. Is it? Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. Bloody love a brassica, those pigeons. And the pests on it's the bigger pest. It is the pigeons and the rabbits, I'd say, at the moment, the biggest issue to us. And the frost has been absolute hellish for the last few weeks. It's just been bone dry with a frost pretty much every morning, and it's just nothing grows. You know, like lettuce wants to be sort of like optimum growing conditions, like 10 to 20 degrees and a bit of moisture. So it's, yeah, we've been hitting those sort of temperatures like by, you know, middle towards the end of the day. But like in the morning, you know, when it's like -2, it's just sat there just going like, I just can't deal with this. Can't deal with this. I want to be on a beach. I think the weather's the biggest challenge for anyone, whatever type of farming you're doing at the moment. Whether you're a dairy farmer or looking at your field of backward rape, it's a big challenge for everyone.
And also, speaking of challenges, I know you farm close to a river, the Wye. Is it the River Wye?
We're a couple up from the Wye, so we are just where the River Arrow flows into the Lug.
Right, okay.
And then the Lug flows into the Wye.
Sure, okay, because we farm right on the River Dee, so I know all about river challenges. But is that become more of a thing, flooding, or in recent years?
Yeah, it's definitely, we've had in the last 15 years, we've had the three biggest flooding events in my dad's lifetime. And to be honest, it floods every year. The river mm-hmm. floods every year. We're used to that, and we don't grow anything other than grass on the land that does flood, because we had in the past, and it's just like, it's just not worth it. Sure. Just, we've lost too many crops to planting on floodplains. But the extent to which it floods has definitely worsened. Like I said, those three big flooding events, and whether there is an element of river management that is down to that, and I'm very much of the, we need to slow the flow rather than straighten rivers and mm-hmm. dredge them and sort of get it off the land faster, because the flip side of the flooding, which affects us almost as much, is the low flows. So if you can slow the flow down, you can like sort of re-wet some of that peat up in the hills and allow that runoff to slow down, so you don't have the massive fluctuations in the river level. We can have a little bit more water in the rivers at the height of summer, so we can irrigate, or the various animal life in there can survive. But we have just, it was February 2020 was the worst. Mm-hmm. And it was just, there was just so much rain. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't so much the river maintenance that was the issue. It was the fact that there was so much
water. Yeah.
It was just relentless. And we'd had it since our farm had been flooded since the 1st of October. And we'd had water on the fields pretty much every day since the 1st of October, right the way through to March. And then that February storm Dennis, it came in our house, and the people who lived in our house before us, so I don't actually live on the farm, I live a few miles away, and our house flooded, and the people who lived here before us were like, we've been there for 60 years and it had never flooded.
Really? Wow.
It's just that level of rainfall, and there's not a lot you can do about that.
No.
I mean, you could, if you want to get that level of water away quicker, you're talking about dredging and widening rivers a hell of a lot to, and it's just not practical. So you got to, goes back to resilience. You just got to find ways to make your farm sort of resilient to the changing weather patterns.
For sure. Yeah. Well, yeah, I totally agree. And it's the same here, really. We've always had flooding. My granddad always said the worst flood in this area was 1949, and when it flooded the whole village. But it's the amount of floods we're getting now that's the difference. So we're getting these sort of once every 20 year floods every year, really.
Yeah.
And it was the same for us. February 2020 was terrible. It was bad this January as well, but last year was worse.
It doesn't because that year, like 2019, 2020, and just like nobody got any winter cereals in the ground, did they? It was absolutely miserable. And it was just the floodland, the stuff that actually flooded, was the least of my worries. It was just the fact that we had the whole of the rest of the farm just wasn't planted.
Yeah.
And the damage that, we had to get out there and pick kale. We said, we're still picking kale. And it's just getting absolutely soaked out there picking it. And, you're having to drive the tractor out and you've got to get it picked. And you're just like chewing the ground up, and it's just breaks your heart.
It's no fun, is it? It's no fun.
No.
I think without talking about flooding too much, because I'm sure we'd talk about that all day as well, but it's hard to describe the damage a bad flood leaves as well. I mean, it's like a hurricane's gone through when it's been here.
Yeah, and fence posts only last about 18 months as well. But I think I look back at some photos of our river meadows back in 2018, and we had some North Devons in, and it was lovely, and it was sort of like up to your knees in grass, and there's like buttercups everywhere, and this lovely big old oak tree in the middle of the field, and it looked absolutely beautiful. But it's been hammered so hard since then that we hardly grazed it last year, and it's just knocked it back hard. And this is permanent pasture that has, it's never been ploughed. We've never ploughed it. We've never done anything to it. And it just, but it always keeps coming back.
Yeah.
But this is the longest that it's just not looked happy.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what I mean. It's a lot. I'm sure I must work it out. I actually always think this, but the compaction must be an issue. The weight of the water.
I mean, if you think, I think in parts, ours was up to 5 foot deep. And on there for, on and off, but for 6 months. Like that's, it's like a ton of water every square meter. That's not going to be doing anything for the compaction. Waterlogged soils. I mean, there's a lot of bacteria, a lot of worms, a lot of microbes, a lot of little, little insects. It's not doing them any favors.
No, definitely. Yeah. Well, something we're both going to have to live with.
Can we talk about something happy?
Yes. Let's go back to the sunflowers. Where's the market for those? What are you hoping to do with them?
Again, luckily, Abel and Cole. It's sort of like that I've been growing them for the stewardship scheme.
Yeah.
And said, would you fancy trying growing some for us as cut flowers this year? I was like, the first thing that kicks in is like the excitement, because I get very overexcited about thinking about a new project.
Yeah.
And then so like it starts to sink in, and then the anxiety starts to take over of like thinking of 500 ways I'm going to cock it up.
Yeah.
It's going to go horribly wrong, because I've had a couple of sort of failed experiments at things in the past, and it sort of knocks your confidence a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like I said, I've put them in with a hand. Little hands push along seed drill thing. Got the seed. We're not doing a huge amount, so the seed isn't a massive outlay. So I thought it's worth a punt, isn't it? It's worth a punt. So yeah. we shall see how it goes. But I might start doing pick your own sunflowers or something like that. But we live right on the edge of an involved town, shall we say, in the countryside, that they'd probably come and pick your own anyway without even
that's the trouble, isn't it?
doesn't usually stop them.
No.
We shall see. I just want them to germinate first. I'm not getting excited until I see some leaves coming up through the ground. So
I will watch with interest on Instagram. Okay, you again like me, you are a tenant farmer. And do you think that sometimes I sort of bang this drum quite a lot, that a lot of changes in agricultural policy going on in the UK, as we know at the moment, you mentioned post Brexit before. Do you think that politicians and policymakers realize how many of us are tenant farmers and have various restrictions?
I totally agree there, and I think a lot of people don't realize quite how tied you are when it comes to things like diversification. People say, oh, you should plant more trees on the farm. It's like, well, I have to run that past the landlord first. Oh, look, those barns make a lovely wedding venue. It's like, well, I'm not going to spend £150,000 doing those up for the landlord to turn around and go, well, that's not technically farming. So I'm going to charge you rent on that on a commercial rate instead of the rent you are paying for it. It's like my family have been tenant farmers pretty much the whole time. So flirted with sort of like minor yeomanry at times, never being gentry or anything like that. And it's there is a I sort of end up sort of getting a little bit sort of French revolutionary and I always remember my grandfather. He came back on my mum's side, he came back from the war, and took on a tenancy on this farm. And then it came up for sale. And he went and got a mortgage for £10,000, 100% mortgage, £10,000. And everyone told him he was crazy.
Of course.
You'll never pay that off. And after he came back from the war, he didn't go abroad again.
Okay.
And he'd been all over the world and he never went abroad again. But I think he took my mum to London once a year. And I heard some stories about him going to the hop exchange in London with one of his mates who grew hops next door, and they missed a train and got too drunk. And that was about the extent of it. But he always had this little sticker in the window, just this little sticker that said like private land ownership is best for Britain or something. And it was like something that stuck with me. And I don't know whether I've had a chip on my shoulder about being a tenant farmer, but I always liked the idea of, you know, I never want to be a big landowner. I never want to sort of be a landlord where I'm renting land out to other people. But the idea of owning my own patch and saying that this is mine and I can do what I want to it, and I'm not beholden to someone in an ivory tower who's got so much money and they don't really need it. And it just gets a bit of a bee in my bonnet sometimes. That I know that we were tenants on another farm. We had a duchy tenancy, and I know that Prince Charles does a lot for new entrants. He does a lot for ecology. He's very open to new ideas and trying different things. But there are some landlords out there who are just there to collect the rent every month and have zero input into it. And we're very lucky that we're on an old AHA generational tenancy. Otherwise, if we're on some sort of like rolling FBT, it'd be like absolute nightmare trying to invest anything, because we are in that fortunate position. But any tenant farmers who want to invest anything in their farm, say you're a dairy farmer looking to put a new parlour in, you've really got to weigh up of, what's the payback on this? What's my tenancy term? Am I going to make the money back from this massive? But because a lot of the time the landlords aren't bothered. They're like, you got to pay for it. And it's up to you whether you pay it back. We don't get any help with repairs or my parents live in the house and it's a big old grade two listed drafty box. Repairing all the windows, stuff like that. It's just it's not in the tenancy agreement. So that's balls in your court there. We are very fortunate that we have got that AHA tenancy. But we have actually just purchased 150 acres, a little farm sort of up in the hills, but it's about 8 miles from us. And I couldn't be happier about it.
I was going to say, you must be absolutely buzzing about that.
And I'm obsessed with it. And I've never seen my dad so animated about farming as well, and so excited about it. And as soon as he got it, the first thing he did, he went to the local tree nursery and bought a load of oak trees. And he's just like, put those in up there. And he's just
brilliant.
Loving it. And it's just land that's got no buildings with it. And so it's then I'm thinking of how often do you get a chance to build a farmyard and do it? Because every farm is bolt a bit on there and bolt a bit extra on there. And you have to take the joist or whatever up because you can't fit the loader underneath it. There's always something where someone's backed a tractor through a wall somewhere. And just being able to sort of start from scratch and think about it. So yes, sustainably as well. So from a rainwater harvesting point of view and soakaways and things like that. And it's an exciting time. And like I said, I don't want tens of thousands of acres. Just if I can run a farm that is producing that is producing good quality, healthy food, and it's doing it financially and environmentally sustainably, then I'm happy.
Amazing. That's so cool. Did you always want to be a farmer when you were growing up? Were you one of those kids who grew up obsessed with farming or not?
No, I'll be honest. I wasn't. It's mostly because, as we were saying before, with dads and to not really talking much. My dad was very much the sort of farmer. You know, we used to grow quite a lot of potatoes, and he used to drive out to the potato field to talk to whoever was on the plant or whatever. And he just like lock me in the Land Rover, disappear for an hour, then come back. Yeah, there was never really any sort of like involvement in it.
Yeah,
so just all my association was with farming was just being bored, sat in a Land Rover from the age of 3 till about 8. So, I used to love being on the potato grader. You know, I was like, I remember my first job getting 50p an hour. Stood on a milk crate, chucking out rotten potatoes. And I did love it. And, you know, working with my grandfather and sort of, you know, sitting on his knee to drive a Land Rover, mm-hmm. learning how to fix fences, just, you know, some pretty basic stuff that I think, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people who want to be a farmer, like from the day they grow up. But I think there are quite a few people who feel they want to get away from it, mm-hmm. and then it's something clicks and you realize actually quite what an amazing privilege that is to have that opportunity and how important it is. And it was like, I did agriculture at university, but I still wasn't 100% convinced I wanted to be a farmer, because I didn't really feel I sort of like fit in with a lot of the farmers back home, and there weren't actually that many farmers like in my year at school for some, mm-hmm. some unknown reason, just a handful of them. But it was at uni, and I just remember it was in a ecology module, and there was like some real chippy vegan at the back of there, and I've not got a problem with vegans, but he was, because I grow a lot of vegetables for them, but he was just like, just on at farmers the whole time. And I was just like, not gonna put up with that, because it's like everything that was coming out of his mouth was not something that I recognized.
Yeah.
It was, and if that was sort of like the way that people saw farming, then, you know, like I didn't want to farm in the way that he was describing it. So it was like, well, you know, it's, doesn't have to be like that. So, mm-hmm. I ended up going home. We were having a bit of a dabble with making dairy products with a couple of other dairy farmers. Something my dad had got in with some of his mates, and it was all going really well. Again, it was like some pretty labor intensive, and I was making all the yogurt, and it was all good. And then 2008 happened. It was a like big crash. But sort of before that, I'd escaped to London for 18 months to work for a food and drink marketing agency. Cause I was like, I've never really been to London much before then. So I thought, well, get out of my system. If I hate it, I hate it.
But yeah,
I feel like I had to give it a try. And yeah, food and drink marketing, and you realize quite how few people, especially food journalists, know bugger all about where food comes from. Like, honestly, it's absolutely baffling. And you'd be talking to like these like top chefs and these food journalists from like some pretty well respected newspapers and magazines, and they knew, you know, bugger all. They'd be like, you know, Channel Island milk is like, oh well, yeah, it just comes from Channel Islands. It's just milk from Channel Islands. It's like, well, so Jersey cows, they're just cows from that live in Jersey, are they? They're like, yeah, okay, right. And so yeah, my boss was like, oh my god, I've got someone who knows about food. Brilliant. So it was like sort of like this like farming consultant at the company. And that was fun, but yeah, lasted, well, it was less than 18 months. I was like, why the hell do people live like this? It's just like that morning commute to work. It just rammed on a tube. It's like just no outdoor space and just constant like noise everywhere. I just couldn't hack it.
You did miss home and the farm.
Yeah. And I think you do. Sometimes it takes taking a step away from something to realize quite what you've got.
Yeah.
Quite how much you'd miss it if it wasn't there.
Yeah.
My brother had no intention of farming, so it would have ended with my parents. So
yeah.
And couldn't be happier now.
Good. So when did you realize growing up that you were gay?
It's one of those things. It's like, you look back at it and you don't, there's not really a light bulb moment. I can't really sort of like pin a date in the diary when the epiphany happened, but it was always there. It was always there. But then you spend so long trying to fit in anyway, because you know what kids are like.
Well, you do that as a teenager anyway, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Because for anything, and kids can like sniff difference a mile off, can't they? And just like they're just around a weak animal, and they will find that weakness and they will exploit it and they will bully it. And so I did absolutely everything, because I was like, that was I was a short little weedy kid, never got picked for any of the sports, and I guess it got bullied pretty horrifically for a fair bit, and so was a bit of an outcast until sort of like 13, 14. And then so like you find us, like my dad was like, you will play rugby, you will play rugby, you will. I was like, I'm shit rugby, I can't catch. So like this absolute humiliation of sort of being forced onto the rugby pitch and just not being able to catch. And he's like, well, if you're not going to play rugby, you're going to have to play some sports. So I tried hockey, again, similar sort of like ball coordination, crap at that. So tried rowing, got into that. And then suddenly, at school, if you're good at a sport, suddenly you're Mr. Popular. And then it was just, then you just feel like the pressure's off a bit then. But it was always at the back of my mind. And you sort of spend that first 18 years to pretending you really fancy that girl over there. Lads, that sort of thing. And then spent the next 18 years after that sort of unpicking it and dealing with it all. But yeah, it would have been nice to have had some sort of role model at the time to just go,
yeah,
it's okay. Because like back then, it was, growing up in the 80s, you had, so the AIDS epidemic was all kicking off. You had Section 28. So, the reason I probably didn't realize I was gay, because like I didn't know it existed. It just was never talked about. There's no one in popular culture. I think even George Michael was straight at that point. So it was, and like everyone was like, oh, no shit when he came out, but still wasn't able to be himself to get a number one single. So it's, it's all in the past now, but it's all probably didn't come to terms with it until properly about 10 years ago.
Okay.
Takes a lot. So coming out was probably the easiest bit.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't great, but it's probably the easiest bit. And then it is that time after that where you sort of like stop resenting the fact and stop wishing you weren't gay and hiding it from people that you don't know, because like even you come out but then you still will talk to people you don't know that well in gender neutral pronouns and things like that. And if people ask you about your wife and have you got kids, and you sort of like change the subject really quickly and you feel really awkward and you're like, oh, I don't want to make a scene. And now I just don't give a shit. And if people have an issue with that, then I'll try to talk to them about it. And but I just find that just being normal and talk, you know, just saying things like talking about my husband, people just don't bat an eyelid. Mm. And a lot of it I find was all in my head. The biggest issues were the internal conflict, and I've had very little issues to my face from it. But you know, I'm sure everyone loves a good gossip. You know what farmers
are. In farming communities. Yeah.
Heaven forbid. There's always something that we're good and natural about, isn't there?
Mm. Yeah. Did going away to uni and getting that sort of, you know, Edinburgh is a big city, or certainly is compared to kind of rural Wales or Herefordshire. Did sort of having that distance and going up there for 4 years, did that help?
Absolutely. I mean, it's about as far away from Herefordshire as you can get. Yeah. So it was, I went up there. My dad took me up there to go to a uni open day. And his cousin, who's like the coolest person in our family, who she runs like contemporary art galleries and stuff in Scotland. And she's just like, it's like, oh my God, it's like one person who's not like a farmer. and we went up there, and I just remember just getting a really good vibe from Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Really, really nice. And it's so like, it's about European, multicultural, metropolitan. It's a really nice city, but you're 10 minutes from the center and you're on Arthur's Seat. Or you can practically walk to the beach, and it is just lovely. And it was no one else I knew there, so I could start from scratch. You could reinvent yourself. Work from the ground up, and it was probably the best thing that happened to me, because I had nothing to hold on to from Herefordshire, really. Yeah, there's no sort of like anybody who really knew the former me. But yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. Learned bugger all about farming. But
yeah. what was your favourite pub in Edinburgh? Edinburgh's got some brilliant pubs, isn't there? I love it.
Yeah. It's like all the bars changed fairly rapidly. I had a job in a fancy cocktail bar called Opal Lounge.
And
they had the MTV Music Awards there.
Brilliant. One year,
and they had the after party there, and I was working in the cloakroom, and it's like that's Christina Aguilera and Pink and Black Eyed Peas, and I was like. There were some cracking pubs. There was one down, it's called the Port of Leith.
I know where that is.
Yeah. And it was my dad's cousin took me there. And it was, you used to like go in, and it was the most, the landlady was proper Bette Lynch sort of, leopard print, peroxide blonde hair. Yeah. So like obviously smoked 40 fags a day, so in the 60s or 70s, big bright red lipstick, so like, you know, probably punch you and throw you out herself if you got out of line. And there'd be such a mix of people in there, you know, there'd be like fishermen, like, and some, you know, just sort of like arty folk and everything. And it was, I just remember that was like my first sort of, it didn't feel just like being in a student union, so like 4 pints for a pound sort of thing.
Yeah. You've already said that your dad is quite hard to talk to. What was it like telling your dad that you were going? I mean, did he know, or did he know deep down? Maybe.
I mean, there were a few they did ask me a few times, and I was like, no, it's fine. It was just a phase, I'll be fine. And then he asked me when I was up at uni, and they came to visit me up there. And I said yes, and then it's sort of like it's like a lot of raised voices and all the tears, and then and they went, and if I'm honest, I think it's probably better with my dad than it was with my mum.
Okay.
I've spoken to a lot of people, and they've said the same thing. I don't know what it is, But yeah, the sort of like the dads have been a bit more pragmatic about it, and yeah, mum really didn't take it well. But fast forward, however many years, and 5 years ago, this coming September, my husband and I got married on the farm. Dad gave a little speech. My mum did the flowers. It was a dream, absolute dream. And honestly, if you had told me that when I was 18, I would not believe you, because I was all ready when I came out, I was ready for it to be over. I couldn't pretend anymore, because it's eating away at me inside. But and you sort of like, you feel you run that risk of like it just absolutely just throwing everything away. So I was so glad. Really so fortunate. I know a lot of people haven't been that fortunate, but the majority of people I've spoken to have said it was the best thing they ever did was coming out, as hard as it was. Like that building up the courage to tell people is the hardest thing. And it just seems such a shame that it is still something that people are going through now. You've got so much representation in the media, but people still feel that they can't be themselves right from day one.
Yeah. In farming communities, do you think that we're, I would say, but then it's easy for me to say because I'm not gay and I've not been in that position, but do you think that we're more accepting now than we were sort of 10, 15 years ago? I mean, I would say we are, but then maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I think it varies, because like everyone I speak to, everything seems absolutely fine. But then you've only got to go on a social media post on the Farmers Weekly website. And I know Matt Naylor did an article for them one time. They put it up on Facebook, and then you get the usual slew of comments just going from like, I think there was the Massey Ferguson in rainbow regalia, and there was someone like, oh mate, you drive Massey Ferguson, this one's you, I was told you Massey Ferguson drivers were bent. It's that sort of level of sort of like juvenile humor, and it doesn't bother me. Like to me, I mean, it can say that to my face all day long, but it's their mates who might be struggling with it and might just be about at the point where they can tell their friends, and then their mates go and say something like, oh, you wouldn't catch me in one of those, I'm not a bender, sort of thing. And it's just it just like reinforces that the pejorative of gay is a bad thing, and it's there's bugger all you can do about it. And then it does swing to the slightly more malicious, and then I know that the Farmers Weekly, who were incredible at supporting just diversity across the board in farming, and they got a letter from someone saying, I've been a subscriber all my life, I'll never buy another copy again if you continue to promote these disgusting lifestyle choices, things like that. It's like, just like give it a break. I don't care how like how other people live their lives. Like people are like, oh, why have you always got to bring like sexuality into it? Why have you always got to like talk about that? Farming's got nothing to do with it. And they're like, and then in the same breath, nobody will comment on, Jeff, who wrote Denise, Will You Marry Me, out of hay bales in a field. And it's just that sort of level of it's so, in farming, like farmer and a farmer's wife, it's such a ubiquitous scene, that everyone, nobody realizes quite how often, that trope is put out there, of the, a farmer in a flat cap on a combine with his wife bringing him a flask of tea. Yes. And then and a ham sandwich.
Oh, my wife hates being called a farmer's wife. She calls me the farmer's husband.
And that's it. And I know so many women who are the farmer,
exactly,
in their own right, and their husband does something else, and a sales rep will turn up on the farm and go like, "Oh, all right, love, is your husband around?"
Yeah.
I know some people say it, and it's probably just because it is that sort of assumption that is very easy to make. But then I was chatting to someone else who said that she's some sort of Scottish tourism thing, and her name is, I think it's Doctor. And she was supposed to be meeting someone and came down and so met this guy in the lobby and said, "Oh, hi there." And then, "Oh yeah, I am Dr. So-and-so." And the chap said, Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I thought you were his secretary." And then didn't leave it at that. Said, "Because you're a woman, and because, I assumed that, a doctor would be a man." Mate. And it's like,
"Oh, mate."
It's like, really not doing yourself any favors there. Just stop talking. Geez. Stop talking.
Yeah. Okay. So, I guess something that has helped gay farmers or people in the farming or rural community in recent years has been the wonderful AgriSpect, something that you've been involved with from the start. Tell us a bit about that and how you came to be involved.
Yeah, so Matt Naylor, who is, we both know Matt, is like a polymath. He is like a farm genius. There is like nothing that he can't do. Everything he does, it just just works. And he called me up one day, and he was in the car with another Ben, Ben Firth over in Lincolnshire. Mm-hmm. And they'd been chatting because there'd been a piece on Countryfile about gay farmers, and it was a piece about depression and suicide in the farming community and within gay farmers, and we were chatting about it because we felt that we didn't recognize that in our own lives. I mean, we were just going about doing our thing, and there was this message coming from this Countryfile piece that all farmers have it hard enough without being gay, and then they've got that to deal with as well. And I feel that sort of, whilst it's super important to highlight those mental health issues, it doesn't really give anyone any hope who might be struggling with their sexuality, because they see that and they go, "Oh, well, yeah, I am, you're right, I am suicidal and depressed." Mm-hmm. And well, that is the life of a gay farmer. There's not much to do about it. So we thought, well, how about we promote the fact that you can be, living your best life, be out, LGBT, working in the agriculture sector, whether that's farmer or an agronomist or, working in a feed mill or whatever. And it started off with just a couple of stories from people we knew, like farm consultants, farm lawyer. And it started to escalate from there, and we had other people messaging us, and social media is incredible for that. So it just ballooned, and we got got various organizations to sign a pledge to say that they will not tolerate homophobia within their organization. So whether that was Farmers Weekly or the NFU, got Michael Gove to sign it back when he had his little stint at the at DEFRA. So it was it was incredible, because it's the sort of thing where now if you go to an organization and say, "Are you going to put something in your some sort of policy in place that ensures that you aren't discriminating against someone based on their sexuality?" And like, no one's going to say no, are they? Because that would be absolute corporate suicide. But it did, it really did help sort of like get that conversation going, and also want to encourage new entrants into farming. And like, for me growing up, like I said before, you know, never really felt like I fitted in with sort of farmers my age, because it was, it's like, oh, well, there are no farmers like me. And like the thought of disappearing off to Edinburgh where I could, you know, be myself, or going to London and getting that out of my system, because I couldn't be, you know, or I couldn't, didn't have the space to really to discover myself. Mm-hmm. It's the most disgusting turns of phrase that I absolutely, absolutely hate finding myself. But it is true. And if you're still feeling sheltered and, you know, shielding your true self because you're worried what people are going to think of you, then you can't bring, you know, your A game to the table. And it might be pushing people away from farming who we could really do with keeping, because sure. Farming has got a massive skills gap, as you are well aware. And whether that's preventing farmers' sons and daughters from moving away because they feel that farming is not accepting of them, or whether it's turning off people from urban areas and who are like, actually, yeah, I'm quite interested in farming, but actually, yeah, I don't fancy it because it's a bunch of stuffy old men and their wives and baking cakes and making jam. nothing wrong with cake and jam, though.
No,
cake and jam. But yeah, it's all about sort of starting up that conversation to just, because if people can talk about it, and Matt put that brilliant talk on at Oxford Farming Conference, mm-hmm. that you did a talk at, mm-hmm. and it was diversity across the board. So whether it's race, gender, or sexuality, just being able to, have everyone else's back, because, you know, like, I can't say that, I feel persecuted as a gay farmer, mm-hmm. and then not, you know, speak out when I see racism in farming. And the same with, like, as we're saying with women farmers.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think it's something that came up with the Lord James Haskell situation. I might have started a bit of a Twitter storm there. Just that need to highlight female farmers, because you don't say male farmers, and it's like a lot of things, you know, when it's like a female jockey or a female this, because they can't just be referred to as that profession in their own right, because, you know, they've got to put female in front of it because it sort of like makes it other.
Yeah, well, I in sort of research for this interview, I did a bit of Google stalking, and yeah, quite a lot of the headlines that came up for interviews and things you'd done, it said gay farmer Ben Andrews. And I guess that irritates you, but then I suppose it's something you've talked about.
Yeah, it depends, because one of my biggest insecurities was that if I was a rubbish farmer, people would say it's because he's gay,
mm-hmm.
not because he's a rubbish farmer. And I'd, you know, I don't, if being the gay farmer helps other people, then I'm fine by it. But I don't want to be judged by it.
No.
Because it's something that I don't have control over. So if I'm going to be judged, I want it to be, sure. I want to be judged for something that, you know, like I've managed to fuck up myself. So, but it's, that doesn't bother me. Like I said, because if it's helping people, then that's great. But there is a level, you know, can get a little tedious sometimes when the Farmer's Guardian feature article thing, someone came and interviewed me and it was nice that I was just able to just like, you know, I just like dropping in John, you know, like husband, you know, in conversation, just making it normal because it is normal. Like, you know, it's not like, and then people ask me like loads of questions about it, and I'm just like, oh, you know, I just try and just get on and do what I do, because you know, I have so little time to think about anything else other than actual farming and getting on and doing the day-to-day stuff.
It's
such a tiny, it's a very important part of my life, but it's such a, my day-to-day existence, it is, you know, very, very, very small part of my life, and has very little impact on what I actually what I actually do, apart from maybe wearing t-shirts that are too small and make it hard for me to work properly. But
yeah, you're gonna struggle with planting verge wearing some of those t-shirts.
I haven't bought any for about 20 years.
Yeah, and after Google, so I should say, and I told you this, but I did end up on a magazine feature you did with the headline. I think the headline was something like "Handsome Gay Farmer," and on that page there was a lot of very handsome, muscly men, and it left me feeling very, very inadequate when I.
it's one of those things where. It's like it's all sort of social media and TV and stuff like that, and it's, there's so much that is image based. It's all and like, yeah, the gay world is probably the worst for it, because it's like straight men squared, because like it's a bit like back in the 90s of like the FHM days. And it's a bit of a double-edged sword. I might have capitalized on it a little bit to, you know, get my message across, but when things sort of start with handsome or you know, and the, you know, the first thing that is like on an article sort of like is a comment about your appearance, I want to take this seriously, and it just like this gets you down about social media. It's like when you post a selfie and whatever, and it's great getting like some, you know, nice comments to stoke your ego a bit. But it's like, you know, when you post something that you actually, so try to keep the balance on the Instagram posts fairly factual, and I like to, you know, have a bit of a rant occasionally. And I'm like, can someone please read the caption underneath the picture? It's like, there's an important message here. Made a bit of a rod for my own back, I guess.
Are you on Instagram? And I do urge people listening, if they're not following you on Instagram, to find you on there, because you are really, well, number one, you take some really good pictures, but your Instagram account is great, and it is really good at, I don't know, about just getting across the farming story, I suppose. You're a really good communicator. But did you set out to do that, to sort of deliberately share the farming and food story, or were you just having fun with it and it just kind of took its course?
Yeah, it's sort of, I never have a plan for anything. That's the first thing. I never actually sit down and work anything out or think, well, this is what I'm setting out to achieve from this. But there was an element of the teaching people who don't know about farming, because I've got a lot of friends, like going back to what I was saying about in London, with people who were very intelligent, who knew very little about where food comes from, and the level of food waste that goes on with some people, and just really, so that really upset me. And there is that, also that polarization that doesn't seem to be getting any better. And hoping to try and to bridge a bit of a gap between sort of farmers and consumers, between town and country. That's a big old thing that I don't think it will ever get healed while social media is around.
No.
I've had a very tempestuous relationship with social media, especially recently, because there are, one thing I've noticed is that there are, and I'm I'm really sort of chilled out about these things. And like I said, I have a plan, and I sort of like chat to people, and there are, you know, met some incredible farmers through social media. And
yeah,
like one of my mates, Ed Horton, who he came up to visit and have a play with my planter, met him through Instagram, and just really enjoyed just like just getting all his knowledge, because he's like such a massive brain box with farming as well. And there's some incredible people, but then I've only just recently started to realize how many people are playing a massive game on how to get the most followers and just become famous and sort of like build their own brand. And then I've heard some, like some pretty nasty things about people, the lengths people go to and you know, how they will drag other people down just so that they can get to the top. And it's, it really does. It's tragic because you think that, you know, in the farming community, we all want to bring each other up. Like I have some great banter on Instagram with the various other farmers, and it is all just a bit of fun. And I've never felt that, you know, anyone's sort of like trying to, you know, like drag me down. But I was talking to a friend of mine, and they suffered a pretty prolonged abuse from someone, because this person didn't like that they might be potentially more Insta famous than them. So it just, and I'm like, why? I mean, why do people like take it that seriously? Because at the end of the day, like, you know, and I think pretty much everyone on social media has at some point been contacted by a TV producer to say like, oh, I've got this great idea for a new TV show. And I've given up replying now because you go through this really long, prolonged thing, and they want to record you talking to the video, and you do it all, and then it goes dead, and you've wasted like hours of your life trying to do it. And I just had a think about it, and I just thought, I want to be a farmer. I don't want to be someone on telly who then no longer has time to farm and has to get someone else to do it all for them. And it just like, I've seen how that sort of life can ruin people. And you know, I don't think anybody really manages to hit that balance.
No.
It just doesn't, it doesn't, never tends to end up well. And you can get a bit like blinded by the idea of, you know, oh, it's going to make me rich, famous, and everyone's going to love me, and I'm going to be on Strictly Come Dancing, and then just like, actually, you know what? I just want the quiet, quiet life. And so I've not done anything on Instagram for a bit, just because I'm like, there's always someone who wants to argue with you. I haven't got the energy for it. And it's a shame, because there's a lot more that I want to say, and a lot more that I feel that you know I want to share about farming, and about, you know, sustainability and climate change, and how we can, you know, how a lot of the figures in the media are portrayed poorly, and how farming has been made a scapegoat for climate change, and sort of fossil fuels seem to be getting the easy way out. When you sort of just constantly getting people going like, oh well, you know, I think you should be doing it this way, I think you should be doing it that way, you can't help but take it personally.
Yeah, it does get draining. I mean, I have a very love-hate relationship with social media as well. There's bits where I love connecting with people from all around the world, farmers and non-farmers, and that's the best thing about it. But yeah, it does get draining. Sometimes you post a picture of something you're doing on the farm, and then you get you get a few people sort of, well, why are you doing it that way? Why don't you do it? And you think, oh, mate, it's just a picture. Can you, have you deduced all that from one picture, you know, my entire farming system? And it just gets tiring, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you do a lot more on Twitter than I do, don't you? You're like, you're big on Twitter.
For my sins. Yeah.
It's a funny old place, Twitter, isn't it? Mm. I tried not to get too involved with it because I just see, yeah. And I can turn into a bit of a keyboard warrior. And I'm like, I'll be up late at night if someone's wrong on the internet. Nobody wins.
They don't.
In an argument on Twitter, nobody wins. You end up like lying in bed fuming.
Yeah. And it's taken me far too long to realize that, but I finally got there. Ben, where do you see yourself in the future, 10, 20 years? Would you? I guess you'd like to build a farm on the land you've just bought.
It's funny, isn't it? Because if you'd asked me like 20 years ago, oh, where would it be in 10 years? 10 years seemed like a hell of a long way in the future, didn't it? And I look back at 10 years now and I think, I don't feel like much has changed in 10 years. Yeah. So it's amazing how the older you get, it just accelerates, doesn't it? So I'll probably still be waiting for my sunflowers to germinate. I would like to just have the new farm running to its best potential and see a few more wild birds and wild flowers up there. But it's, I think, just generally, I mean, I just love that it's where's farming going to be in 10, 20 years. I think the post cap thing, there are a lot of farmers I know around here that I see and I think, amazing, you're still going. And I think there are a lot of farmers, especially around here, that might not quite, unless they start jumping on some, some agri environment schemes, there's going to be quite a few people not in farming for much longer. But I would love to see sort of farming go from strength to strength in this country and sort of pushing it in, working towards that net zero goal.
Good place to leave it. Let's end quickly with the traditional hard-hitting questions. What's your all-time favorite song?
All-time favorite song would probably be Frankie Knuckles, Your Love. Bit of a very early house music classic, that one.
That's a very good choice. I like that. Very cool. If you hadn't wanted to be a farmer, what do you think you would have done instead? Obviously wouldn't have stayed in London.
I did. Well, it's funny, like when I was I've dabbled at a few things and photographer was one of them.
Okay.
Did a few weddings.
I can see that from your Instagram feed.
But my anxiety can't deal with my anxiety and brides just don't work
big,
well together.
Big
and,
pressure, isn't it?
Yeah. So I actually talked myself out of a few weddings because I just got vibes from the bride. It was just like whatever I do is not going to be good enough. So
I know exactly what you mean. If you could choose a lifetime supply of anything, not money, we'll make it kind of money, but what would it be?
Dogs.
Yeah. I think that might be the correct answer.
I remember having a dream of having just having a pack of dogs just living out in the field, just like feral dogs. They were all Lancashire Heelers because I've got a Lancashire Heeler. Just have a whole pack of them.
Brilliant. Feral.
Brilliant.
Okay. Yeah. What's the worst fashion decision you've ever made?
Plenty. I always liked to think I was a little bit avant-garde with my fashion choices, especially when I was at uni. But I've always been one that the moustache is not my first foray into facial hair design. And I've had many different many different things, from like little tiny thin like beard things to one of those, whatever those
are, very hipster,
call at the bottom yeah, on the bottom lip. Yeah, a full grown beards, big old sideburns. Yeah, I've tried it all.
Okay. And lastly then, what is your favorite agriculture related social media account to follow?
Probably at the moment, the Super Serious Farmer. I don't know if you know who Chris is, Chris Woodhead, but he pretty much summed up every farm influencer on Instagram, and is a great antidote from people who take themselves far too seriously on social media.
I will have a look. I haven't seen that account, but I will definitely have a look. Sounds right on my street. Ben, been fantastic to speak to you.
Great.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Really excited about your farm for you. I think that'll be amazing. And I've no doubt it'll go from strength to strength. And hopefully as things start to open up, I will catch up with you somewhere soon.
Just pop down the A49 and say hi.
Yeah. Although Herefordshire never seems like very far away, but it always just seems to take forever to get there.
Herefordshire is 2 hours from anywhere.
It kind of is, isn't it? It's like going through a bloody time tunnel to get there. I always think, well, it's not that far away. And then I could be in London quicker than I could be in Hereford.
It's bloody farmers blocking up the road.
That's I think it is. Yeah. I think it is. All right. Cheers, Ben. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.